Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, starting the show today by taking a look at astronomy with our old friend Paul Kinzer back with us. He's the author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy, and Paul's a member of the La Crosse Area Astronomy Club. He's been with us for quite a long time. Over the years, we've talked with him about a lot, and today we're going to hear a bit about Sunspot, that one that's a senior citizen, I guess we could say. We'll look at how to see Mars, Saturn, and Venus in the night sky. We're going to be talking about light pollution at night and a whole lot more. And, of course, we want to hear from you with your questions, maybe about optics, maybe about the night sky. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Paul Kinzer, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Just the other day, I was looking back myself. I think it was 18 years ago was my
18.
First. 18 years ago, yeah.
Time flies when you're having fun.
Mm-hmm.
Well, which astronomical events do you look forward to this summer?
I always look forward to, whenever somebody says summer, the Perseid meteor shower.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, this year, a meteor shower is when we pass through debris left behind by a comet when it went through. And so every August 11th, 12th, 13th, we pass through a bit of, I believe it's Comet Halley that people say Halley, but he would have said Halley. And the number of meteors you might see goes up quite a bit. Sadly, this year there's going to be a pretty big moon in the sky, which means you just won't see as many. But it's just something to look forward to. Otherwise, just getting out, and I won't lie, the next few weeks are kind of the worst time of the year to go out because the nights are so short around the summer solstice. It really doesn't get what they call astronomically dark until about 11 p.m. And by 4, it's definitely getting light again. So,
Yeah, I'm up at about 5:30 every morning, mm-hmm. and so I get to see a little, but not as much as in the middle of winter.
Yeah, right. I mean, I tell the kids, I travel around with my planetarium, and when I'm at schools in the winter, I always say to the kids, okay, after supper tonight, go out and look at the night sky. You can't do that now.
Oh, well, why should somebody give stargazing a shot if they've never tried it? I'm wondering, is it worth losing the sleep over?
I
think it is.
I absolutely think it is, especially, I know I'm not a deer hunter, but I know, people have deer stands they go up in because deer don't look up.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think people often look up either. It's there. It's the entire universe, and all you have to do is tilt your head back when it's dark out. And even if you're in the middle of a city, not so much like Chicago, but even there, you can see the moon, you can see planets. Sadly, you can't see any stars, but especially here in Wisconsin, we have so many places. If you're out on vacation, traveling around, camping, we light our fire, we look at the trees, we look at the animals, we go on hikes by the creeks. Well, if you're up when it gets dark, just look up.
Look up.
Yeah. And now with smartphones especially, if you're wondering, what is that? There are so many apps out there that you can get for almost nothing. You just point your phone at the sky and it'll tell you, what is that I'm looking at? And then, if you're curious, you can just search for more information on it. That's sure changed since when I was young.
Yeah, it has indeed. Same for me. How much can you see with the naked eye? Of course, you can see the moon. You can.
It all depends on where you are. If you are in a dark place, far from city lights or, frankly, even farm lights, one of the darkest places I've been anywhere near here, and it's not that near, it's like a 9-hour drive, is the Sand Hills of Nebraska. They don't even have farms out there. They have ranches because it really is sand. And if you drive off the road, you need to get towed out. Ask me how I know. But it's so dark there, you can read by starlight, not moonlight. I was able to read just by the brightness of the stars because the human eye in real darkness can really get used to the dark and see pretty darn well. But even one light kind of wrecks that. So in that kind of light, you can see thousands of stars at any given time. And in the summer, this is one of the wonderful things about the summer. The Milky Way just spans the entire sky. And people who've never seen the Milky Way, if you haven't, and you are going to go somewhere dark this summer, I really encourage you to look up and tell yourself, that's hundreds of billions of stars. Some of those stars are only a few trillion miles away. The closest star is 4 light years away. And a light year is how far light travels in a year. It's a measure of distance, and it's almost 6 trillion miles. So the nearest star to us is about 25 trillion miles away. That's the closest. There are stars you can see in the sky that are thousands of light years away. So if you look up and you see that cloud, the Romans named it the Milky Way, and to them the word way meant road. It's kind of a straight line in the summer across the sky, and it looks like a road, and it kind of looks like it's made out of thin milk. And it wasn't until 1609 Galileo aimed a telescope at it, and I imagine said, "Mamma mia," because he was the first person to know that's stars. Those are stars. And he could tell where he was looking, not hundreds or thousands, millions. And again, we now know it's hundreds of billions of stars.
It's amazing. We're in something now called, I think it's called solar maximum.
Yes. The sun goes through an 11-year cycle. Again, right around the time of Galileo, he saw spots on the sun using one of the first telescopes. He didn't put his eye to it. Please don't do that when you're looking at the sun. He put a piece of paper or something at the end of the telescope, and an image of the sun appeared, and he could tell there were little dark spots on it. We have been keeping track of those sunspots ever since for over 400 years. And we have found that pretty much, you know, it can vary a little bit, but every 11 years it goes from bright to dim and back to bright again. And by bright, I mean lots of sunspots. And we now know that when there are sunspots, there's lots of activity going on the sun. It's when we're more likely to have northern lights. It can actually affect satellites, artificial satellites.
What is a sunspot?
It is it's a magnetic storm on the sun.
Okay.
And I don't quite know what that means. And it's not, it looks dark, but it's actually not dark. It's just everywhere around it is super duper bright. So it's just dimmer and seems dark to us when we look at it. But it's where magnetic fields are just kind of acting crazy. And it can lead to things called flares and coronal mass ejections. That corona is the outside of the sun. And parts of it can get blown off the sun. And sometimes they head right for Earth. And about 2 days later, it's 93 million miles away, so it's going very fast. Little tiny bits, ionized hydrogen, just, you know, protons, neutrons, they smack into the Earth's upper atmosphere, and that's what causes the northern lights.
And they're beautiful.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And again, you know, in the last couple of years, we've had some pretty major shows of northern lights.
Yeah. We could see them even in Madison.
Well, last year when my wife and I went to Southern Illinois to see the solar eclipse, we met some folks there from Mississippi who had seen northern lights a few weeks before that. So, yeah.
Paul Kinzer, our guest, as we talk stargazing with him. Paul's the author, as a matter of fact, of the book. Great book. It's titled Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. Questions for him or comments, I hope you'll join in. Number to call 800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking stargazing today with Paul Kinzer. Great to have him back. And if you have a question or a comment or maybe an experience to share, question about the stars, the planets, the optics, I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I want to hear about this sunspot 4100. And this sunspot, I think in the press they're calling it, and maybe elsewhere, a senior citizen.
Yeah, somebody, maybe more than one person, but this person has taken pictures of it. It's now crossing the face of the sun for the third time. The sun spins around in a little less than a month, and it's kind of hard to say just how much because it's not a solid thing. So parts of it rotate faster than other parts, but about a month. So if a sunspot comes out, if you're looking through a telescope, you know, it can be either right or left, but it comes out on one side, and then over a period of several days, each day you look at it, it's moved a little further. And the way I look at it, my telescope, it starts on the left, and 5-6 days later, it goes away on the right. And often, a sunspot will come out, and it's tiny, and by the time it goes around the other side, it's huge, or the other way. Well, this one's been very stable, and this is the third time it's gone around. And the reason that they think it might last even longer is, unlike most sunspots, this one has been very stable. It isn't getting bigger. It isn't getting smaller. It isn't spitting stuff out. It's just sitting there, and it's got a ways to go. It's been there for 54 days now, and the record holders are 121 days for a sunspot in 1840 and 41. And 134 days in 1919. So it's got a ways to go, but I didn't know this was a thing. I had heard about them going around another time, but never two, three, and those other ones seven or eight times.
So, yeah, it's amazing.
It is cool.
David in Madison has something relating to sunspots, so let's go there. Hi, David. David, are you there?
Okay. Yeah, I'm here. Amazing. You there?
Yeah, turn your radio down.
Okay, let's see if I can turn it off here. Okay, hear me okay now?
Yep. Yeah, we're good. Yeah.
Okay, I was a presenter at a natural history museum in New Mexico, and we used to cover sunspots quite a bit. And I was just hearing your guest there say he wasn't sure exactly what a sunspot was and why it was so dark. And the explanation is that, yeah, it's a magnetic storm, and when the magnetic field lines get tangled up, they tend to get really close together, and they drag all the surface gas together. What it's doing, it's compressing the surface gas so tightly that instead of it all being ionized, so it'd be single protons, or essentially single ionized hydrogen atoms floating around, they squeeze back to being molecular so that they bond to each other. And what that means is it drops the temperature.
Ah.
And like he explained, the lower temperature makes it seem darker. It really is incredibly hot. So you're talking about a difference between a surface temperature of like 7,000-8,000 degrees versus a surface temperature of like 5,000 or 6,000 degrees. So it's still bloody darn hot.
Yeah.
It's just, it's cooler, so it looks dark.
Well, thanks for that.
Yeah, thank you, David. That's, you always learn something on this show.
And it's going to be something that I'm going to add to my little facts in my head that I now have. Thank you for that.
Thanks, David. Appreciate it very much. Brian in Marquette, Michigan has something different. Let's go there. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Larry. One summer I worked as a backcountry ranger on Iowa Royal National Park, and this was in 2016. And I mean, I've seen Northern Lights before, like quite a few times, but that was probably like the most ridiculous amount of Northern Lights I've seen in my life. It was about once every week and a half I was seeing them. And there's a couple cases where I was looking up and you know, they're all shimmering, and it was a very ghostly dancing across the sky, all different colors. But I had to go. Actually, I had to go look south to go see them.
Yeah,
which kind of blew my mind. Yeah. So yeah, it was really cool, and wanted to share.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah, and we're getting more and more looks at them too, because especially newer phones, they see light at night better than our eyes do, and people will show me images, and I'm like, I saw those northern lights, but I didn't see those colors. Well, the phones are more sensitive to that. And now, you know, nearly everyone, not me, still don't have a smartphone, but most people, oh, look at that. And they take a picture of it and they put it out there and share it. And that's wonderful.
Yeah. It's a great story, Brian. I've thought back to my most favorite one, and I probably told this on the air, but I was fishing in northern Wisconsin, and I was in my cabin. I realized I hadn't done some things. I woke up in the night, and I thought, oh, I got to get down to the boat and make this, whatever it was I was doing. I think it had to do with the battery for one of my motors. And I get down to the lake, and I look up, and it's just... the sky's full.
You looked up.
I looked up. And it was the, you know, sometimes they're not real bright. And this one was really bright with colors. Yeah. And it was amazing.
You know, I say we take pictures of them now. Now we have ways of knowing when maybe they're going to happen. But to me, one of the mysterious but also really cool things is we never really know. You know, you're like, well, there might be, there might not. Oh, look at that, look at that. And then they're suddenly super bright. We won't know what colors they're going to be. You can't predict what the pattern they make is going to be. So it's unlike a lot of astronomy where you can get a map that was made 50 years ago and it will show you where the stars are. They've moved a little bit, but not much. The planets, we know exactly where they're going to be. But things like the northern lights, meteors, comets, things happen in the night sky that are surprising, and that's something I love keeping track of too.
Yeah, absolutely. You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And you mentioned planets. Let's talk about what's in the night sky right now. Mars. We got Mars, Saturn, and Venus. What about?
Jupiter I almost don't want to mention it because it's so low in the west now that in the next few days, maybe already, it's setting with the sun. But Mars is still out in the evening sky, and you can find it. It's in the western sky after the sun goes down, and you can still tell it's Mars because it's sort of orangey yellow. And then if you want to see other planets, you've got to wait until 2:30 in the morning. That's when Saturn will rise. Saturn went down with the sun a month or two ago, and now it's coming up a little before the sun as it went around it. And it's rising at about 2:30. And about an hour later, Venus will come up. And you can't miss Venus. It is the brightest thing in the sky after the sun and moon. Or it can be, and right now it's quite bright. And it is closer to the sun than us, so sometimes it can actually get closer to us than any other planet, 25 million miles. A lot of people think it's Mars. Mars, the closest it gets is about 35 million, and Mars is much smaller, and Venus is closer to the sun. It's about the same size as Earth, and it's covered in clouds. All of that makes it very, very bright when it's near us in the sky. So that's cool.
Yeah, it is indeed. One of the things that I know you're passionate about is saving our night sky.
Yeah.
There are a couple of threats, I think, one is light pollution, of course, and something you call space pollution. Let's talk light pollution. Well, you go ahead.
Okay. I really wanted to talk about this when I'm on here now, because a month ago, I was in my little town, Galesville. I was invited to be a presenter at their annual Environmental Day. And this year, their theme was Environmental Heroes. And I tried to think, well, what can I do? Because they kind of wanted us to, if we could, think of a way that the kids themselves could be environmental heroes. So I went and I talked to them about light pollution. I'm a sustaining member of Dark Skies International, the group in the world that is doing its best to get rid of light pollution. And light pollution is any light that isn't needed. That, you know, we need light at night. Yes, of course we do. But not as much as we have. And we certainly don't need to shine it up in the air where it's just a waste of electricity and it destroys our vision of the night. It's bad for animals. It's bad for our own health. And it blinds us. We can't see as well at night. Animals, honestly, some of them don't know what to do. They're even finding now that there are trees when their leaves grow, when they fall off, they're confused.
Some research on that in London that really precisely showed that.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, I went there and I brought a flyer from Dark Skies International. It's a very simple thing that shows different kinds of lights, lamps, you know, the things we light up the sky with. Some are good where they, like I, on my house, I have a light that is on a timer. It only goes on when somebody's moving around in the yard. 1 minute later, it goes off because I don't need it. And it only aims the light downward. It doesn't just not aim it upward. It doesn't aim it straight outward either. I often think, and I said this to the kids, if you had a neighbor who was playing music really loudly, you would call the police and they'd come and say, turn it down, and they would. But I've had a neighbor's light shining all the way through my house for every one of the 20-some years I've lived in that house. It's on all night long. It's a kind of light called, and this is a trade name, the Yard Buster. And it shines straight through my house, even into my backyard. And we don't recognize that. And this was so new to the kids, they hadn't thought about it. And then we went on a walk outside the school. And we looked at the lights on the school, in the parking lot, on the street, and talked about what could we do. And they were so excited. And it was like going on, you know, a nature hike where they were excited to point things out. Oh, look, there's one. That one's, I think it's not very good. And it was just really a joy for me to see how easy it is for them to get it. And I heard from the school later that several of them wouldn't stop talking about it, or at least we're talking about it the next day, which is really cool.
Well, so that is definitely something any of us can do.
And there are so many ways. Dark Skies International, if you go to their website, just do a search for that term, they have so many very easy to read flyers and information and like sample ordinances you can take to your town city council to say, here's what we should be doing to limit light pollution. And the thing is, it saves money. You don't need the lights to be as bright, and every bit of the light that's shining up is just wasted money. So we now have the technology, we have the designs to just stop this. And we are. There are more and more what are called dark sky certified sites, Dark Skies International, parks, cities. There's a Native American tribe. I just spent a month in Arizona as an astronomy volunteer at Organ Pipe Cactus National Monument, and they are working to become a dark sky park. And they have to go through certain hoops to do that. They have to make sure their lights turn off at night, that they have the right kind of lights. And they're going to get there. So that's something that's happening too.
You know, we have tree cities, we have bird cities.
Mm-hmm. And now we have dark ones.
And now we have dark ones. Yep. And that would be something that I would think could, with a little publicity, could get going.
I would think that a county, a park, a city that work toward that, even if they haven't made it yet. If you have a dark night sky and you want people to come visit your town, to me, that's a point to make, because most places you can't. Most people in America have not seen the Milky Way.
The other part of that was light pollution and something you call space pollution.
Yeah, I don't know that there is a term other than that for it. I just made that up. In the last decade or so, and it's growing exponentially, humans around the world are launching rockets into space on a daily basis, it seems now. There's a website or a YouTube channel I go to, Scott Manley, and he covers pretty much every rocket launch once a month. And he used to take 4 minutes. There'd be like, you know, one or two or three. Now there are 20 or 30 a month. And China and the U.S., SpaceX especially, they launch, I think, more than pretty much everyone else put together, at least. China might be getting up there now, too. And I do want us sending things into space for communication, for science, things like that. But now most of those satellites are going into things they call constellations, where a single country or a company or the Defense Department of a country is sending up hundreds or even thousands, or even they plan to send tens of thousands of satellites into low Earth orbit. And it's ruining science. Astronomers are saying we, you know, one of the things we have some telescopes that are full time doing now is hunting for asteroids that might hit the Earth. You know, the dinosaurs were wiped out. But even one far smaller than that could, there was one in 2013 that blew up over a city in Russia. If it had been coming in at a little steeper angle and hit the city, maybe a million people would have died. And we didn't know about it until it happened. But now we have more and more instruments aimed at the sky. Well, these satellites are getting in the way, and that's just one way they're getting in the way. And I am not aware of any regulatory, you know, international or even national regulations that that limit them, that look at them, not just what they're doing to the night skies, but all these rockets are leaving all sorts of stuff in the atmosphere every time they go up. Studies are showing there are little tiny particles of all sorts of things getting up there, and that might be messing with the climate. So, you know, some rich people who want to be richer. I just feel like some of it's happening because they can. And I'm not a fan.
Paul Ginzer, our guest today, talking Stargazing with him. He's the author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. Questions for him, or a comment maybe relating to dark sky. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Got an email from Mary. How do you go about getting help setting up a Celestron telescope?
Well, they make lots of different ones. First, I'd say most of them come with a manual that tells you what to do. But I know that if you've never done it before, so many of these things, they're like, well, now you do this. And you're like, I don't even know what that is. I would suggest looking for your local astronomy club. In the La Crosse area, we meet once a month, and you're all welcome to come. First Wednesday of most months, look up LCAAS, the La Crosse Area Astronomical Society, which is a mouthful. I believe, yeah, tomorrow night we're having our meeting. So people are always welcome. And we love, and I know all astronomy clubs do, we love it when people come in wanting help. I can't count the number of telescopes that I've gone over with people and said, oh, well, here's a problem. There's something wrong here or there. And if you don't know, you don't know. And and so we love to help.
There is something called a strawberry moon. And the full moon this month is called the strawberry moon. Why is that? And is there some way that the moon will actually look kind of pinkish?
No. the names that we give to the various full moons, my understanding is those typically come from the Old Farmer's Almanac. And they got them from Native American tribes who had a name for moons throughout the year. I mean, harvest moon is easy. The harvest moon is a full moon around harvest time. And I could show, but I cannot use words to describe. Some full moons are different than others. At that time of year, the full moon rises sort of slowly, and it's big in the sky, and it makes harvesting way easier, and it rises around the same time every night for three or four nights in a row. So good name for it. But there are other ones, the hunter's moon. It's, you know, November-ish.
Yeah.
You know, so that's where those names come from. And I'm not really familiar with the strawberry moon and where it originates, although maybe it's because is this the time of year when wild strawberries are ready to eat? I don't know. At least you didn't mention the blood moon. I have a little trouble with that. It's a lunar eclipse. It doesn't look like blood, folks. It's just a marketing thing. So I guess go ahead, call it that.
Let's. I wanted to talk about your book for a minute because we don't often get to that. But I like your book.
Yeah, I like it too. The sad thing is, Larry, it went out of print a few months ago. Yeah, you can still get the ebook, and of course you can find it used. A lot of libraries have it. I wrote the book again 18 years ago, I was blown away when Cambridge University Press said, "Yeah, we'll publish that," because it was the only book, and in some ways still is the only book, that really is aimed at absolute beginners. I assumed no knowledge of astronomy, the night sky, optics. There's a really extensive glossary in the back, so if I do use a term that maybe is unfamiliar, just look in the back. You know, all of those are in bold the first time they appear in the book. And I also split it into two almost equal parts. The first part is, how do you look at it? I talk about naked eye observing and what might help you with that. Then I go to binoculars, and then I go to telescopes. And I set a price of $600 as a maximum for a beginner, because you literally, just going online, if you wanted to, you could spend $2 or $3 million on your first telescope in its mountaintop observatory. But you don't need to. In fact, 600, like I said, is the maximum. And then the second major part of the book is explaining what's up there. You know, what is a star? What is a planet? How far away are things? What might you be able to look at? What's a star cluster? Things like that, a galaxy, all of those terms that you might not be familiar with. And then again, it ends with the glossary for unfamiliar terms.
It's really, really good. And when you talk about $600, which is more in my price range, Lee Rayburn might go for our technical director. He might go for $1 million. But
yeah, yeah.
What are we really looking at?
Well, the second edition of the book came out in 2015, and there have been some huge developments. I think a major one is smartphones have really had an impact on naked eye astronomy, where you don't need a book anymore. Although when you're looking at your phone, you can get apps that'll keep it red, keep the light red, so your night vision isn't ruined. That's one. But there's now these things, I can't remember, there's kind of a term for them. You don't look through a telescope in an eyepiece. The telescope has a camera, and it shows you a picture. Less expensive ones, under $500, will, through Wi-Fi, send an image that the telescope takes with its camera to your phone. And it takes like a 10-second picture and then another one and another one, and it uses computer software to add them together so that the dim light, say, of the Orion Nebula slowly builds up. And at first it's dim and gray, and after a couple of minutes, it's beautiful and looks like what it looks like in books. And the other thing this thing has is you just go here. You turn it on. You have to upload an app onto your phone the first time. But then it uses GPS. It knows where it is. It knows what time it is. It knows where everything is in the sky and goes right to it. So that's a whole new way for people to look at things. And it's especially good for people who maybe have, like I do, mobility issues in using a regular telescope and trying to aim it and all. It's good for people maybe whose vision isn't what it used to be. So that's a new big one. And the first ones that came out were many thousands of dollars. And then this company that I really like, ZWO, ZWO, a Chinese company, started by an amateur astronomer who is extremely responsive to people saying, hey, you could make this better by doing this. And literally a few months later, boom, there it is. He came out with that one that at first was $600, and I've seen it for $350 now. So that's an exciting new thing. But what I do in the book is I talk about optics, and I explain, what do you want to look for? And the main thing you want to look for in a telescope is aperture, the lens or mirror. The bigger you can get the main lens or mirror, all other things being equal, the better it is. And depending on the kind of telescope, you could get bigger or smaller. And I explain all that. It's a little much to go in here, but there are so many choices.
And at a reasonable rate.
Oh, yeah. And if you're like me, I have never bought a new telescope. The used market, there's a thing we call aperture fever. Somebody gets a telescope and they go, I want a bigger one. And so the one that they bought first, it's sitting there not getting used. So I need to raise money for my bigger one. And so that goes on. And they don't. They may go down in the expense of buying them when they're used, but, you know, they're a telescope. If it's 150 years old, it's still, if it was good then, it's good now. So, yeah.
Paul Kinzer, our guest today. Great talking with him about stargazing and what's going on when we look up in the sky. You can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at stargazing today with Paul Kinzer. He's the author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. Been a guest before, as we were talking about earlier, for 18 years on the show. So it's always great to have him come by. Join in, 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. And let's go to Ed in La Crosse now. Ed, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Okay, he had mentioned that the club meets the first Wednesday of every month. My question is, where do they meet in La Crosse?
They meet at UW La Crosse's, my microphone. they meet in their science building. I'm not remembering the name right now. It's in the basement. It's right by the planetarium. If you go online and look for UW La Crosse Planetarium, we are in the classroom right outside that.
And you, and sometimes go over to the planetarium?
Sometimes we've been doing this thing where during a part of the meeting every month, some of the meeting it's business. You know, we're a nonprofit and we need to do that. But we have been watching a series on astronomy from an organization called Crash Course, which is run by some people I really, really enjoy. And it's just going through astronomy in little 10-minute bites. And we go and we watch that in the planetarium.
Mm-hmm.
And often when we do, and I know, or I'm convinced, if somebody said, hey, can you turn it on? One of our members is the director of the planetarium. In fact, he founded our club long, long ago in the 1970s. Bob Allen is his name. So, yeah, I hope we see you there.
And what time?
7:15, although a lot of us always seem to get there at 7. Parking is difficult until after 7 p.m., so don't come too early because you might get a citation.
Are you guys? Do you guys have a website?
Yeah. Again, if you do a Google search for LCAAS, the La Crosse Area Astronomical Society, I think LCAAS.org, but don't quote me on that. I always just, I have it saved. So, yeah. And that will show you our schedule once a month. We also have public viewing where we go to two different places, one of which, again, will start to be the Galesville Ettrick Trempealeau Observatory, which I helped get built, and it's under some pretty dark skies up between Galesville and Ettrick. And then there's a site we go to near to La Crosse, and we do that every other month, and we do it every month we can, although we don't go out there in the middle of winter usually.
Yeah. So there you go, Ed. I hope you show up for the next meeting is tomorrow.
Yeah. And again, if you look up online, it'll show you when the meetings are. We do outreach events, and we're also always there if people have questions.
And Lee Rayburn says LCAAS.org is correct.
Okay, very
good.
So
there we go. Carl in Madison shot an email in. Sometimes he thinks he sees satellites flying over during the night.
Yeah.
What do satellites look like in the night sky? Are there any websites that can tell you what you're seeing?
Or? Yes. The brighter ones, like the International Space Station, but also, the Hubble and other things like that. There's a website. There are others. You can go to NASA and search there for satellites. I don't have it at my fingertips, but there's another place called heavensabove.com. It's heavens-above.com. And if you put in your zip code or whatever, there's a thing there that will show you various satellites, it'll show you when the ISS, the International Space Station, is going to go over you for the next, I think, 10 days, and what time it will appear to the second, and where in the sky it will be, how bright it will be, and it's pretty cool. The ISS, you can't miss if it's crossing the sky, but a satellite doesn't, the way to tell a satellite from an airplane, some people say it's how fast it's going, but airplanes, they really vary depending on how high they are, how fast they look. All airplanes have a blinking light on them. No satellite does.
Oh.
And satellites go across in a stately way, and they might get dimmer or brighter because what you're seeing, because you can't see them really in the middle of the night, what you're seeing, the satellite that you're looking at, is having the sun shine on it. And you're seeing the sun reflecting probably off solar panels, but reflecting off the satellite down to your eyes. By the middle of the night, our big ball that we live on is in the way. So they're still going over, but you're not seeing the sun shining off them. So that's the way to find them.
How fast are they actually going?
In order to stay in orbit, something has to go at least 5 miles per second. 17,000 miles per hour. And what it's really doing is it's falling around the Earth. It's falling towards the Earth, but it's going so fast that the Earth curves away as it falls, and it just keeps falling around the Earth. And if it was going a little slower, it would drop.
Fall.
And if it goes over 25,000 miles an hour, bye-bye, it leaves the Earth. That's how fast the Apollo spacecraft had to get up to get away from Earth's, they call gravity well. And yeah, so some go faster than others. Some are in higher orbits. Some don't look like they're moving. They're in what's called geostationary orbit. And they're above the exact same spot all the time. That's where weather satellites are and communication satellites. So you don't really see them, even if they were bright enough to see. And I don't know if any of them really are with the naked eye, but they would just look like a star because they don't move. So
John's wondering about binoculars.
Ah.
how well can they work in place? Yeah, and frankly, I'd bet that a lot of people listening have a pair of binoculars.
Sure, most people do.
Yeah.
Thanks for bringing that up, because it usually gets, or often gets, left out. Binoculars are wonderful. They allow you to see a better look at the moon. You can kind of make out craters. And I'm just going to quickly talk about the best ones for astronomy. The lens on the front, the objective lens, the lens aimed at the object you're looking at, the big lens, you want that as big as you can comfortably hold. They make binoculars that are pretty huge. Most of the ones you're going to find in Walmart or wherever, or sporting goods stores, the biggest are probably, they have a 50-millimeter objective lens. That's about 2 inches. You want to get that. And there are a lot of them now. They have zooms and all this stuff. You don't want that. You don't want super high power, because usually it's digital and kind of crummy anyway. But 10 by 50. 10 means how many times it magnifies. 50 is how big that is. That's the best. 7 by 35 is fine. Any binocular will show you more than your eye can see. But those are just some recommendations. You can see a whole bunch of really beautiful star clusters, and you can see the color of the stars much better through binoculars than your naked eye. And there are things you can barely make out with your eye, like what's that fuzzy thing? You aim binoculars at them, and that big old lens can take in way more light than the pupil of your eye, so you can see things you can't otherwise see. There are dozens of galaxies other than our own you can see. Sweeping across the Milky Way with binoculars is really cool. Lots of stuff. You can see 4 of Jupiter's moons with a regular pair of binoculars. You can't quite see Saturn's rings. You need a small telescope for that. But, yeah, very, very, very cool for astronomy.
It's and something probably 90% of the people have at least.
And, again, you going camping, you probably have your binoculars with you. Just aim them up and turn off those bright flashlights.
Rebecca in Woodville emailed us. Her husband died 3 years ago, had a battery-operated telescope. Mm-hmm. Doesn't know the brand off the top of her head, probably 25 years old. She wonders, now she never used it. She'd like to sell. Is there a way to sell a used telescope? Every time you took it outside, it would automatically find the current location of heavenly bodies. It was very cool.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to recommend another site called cloudynights.com. One word, cloudy nights. It's where we astronomers go when it's cloudy. They have a classifieds section, and I think it gets probably more views than any other. And you don't have to pay money to put stuff up there. Check that out. They also have so many forums on every kind of astronomy there is. If you're a beginner and you don't know anything and you want to know something, go to Cloudy Nights. There are, so many of the people there are people like me who want to share their love of astronomy.
That would be, and she'd want to have as much information as she could about the brand and whatever.
Well, a really good thing for her to do would be to maybe post a picture of it somewhere and say, what is this? And get information that way. Yeah, very good idea.
That makes a lot of sense. Paul, this is always a lot of fun.
It is.
Thank you so much for being with us, and let's work on 19 years.
Yeah. I'll be here. I'll be ready.
Paul Kinzer, author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy, our guest today. Just a quick tomorrow on the show, David Drake and Jamie Nack are back to give you some wildlife news, and we'll also be interviewing the new secretary of the Wisconsin DNR, Karen Hyun, and it'll be our first time talking with her, so looking forward to that as well. And of course, a whole lot more coming up next. We're going to take a trip to Oconto. I'm Larry Mueller.